This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. In 1999, Robert Morgan's novel Gap Creek catapulted to New York Times bestseller status. Oprah picked it as a book club selection, and 12 years later, the poet and writer authored the promised sequel to Gap Creek. It's called The Road from Gap Creek, and he joins us now to talk about it. Robert Morgan, welcome back.
Oh, good to be here.
Well, you did it. Gap Creek, very successful. Did you feel a lot of expectations right as you wrote that, when that book came out, to write the sequel?
Well, almost from the day the book came out, I began to get emails and letters asking for a sequel. People felt the story wasn't finished, that they wanted to know what happened next. And I agreed with them that though Hank and Julie at the end of Gap Creek are coming back up to North Carolina and she's already expecting another child, I knew I wanted to live with these characters a little bit more.
You can't leave us with a pregnant protagonist like that and not have a sequel.
But unfortunately, at the time, I was in the middle of writing the novel, This Rock. Mm-hmm. And for years, I had planned to write the novel that became Brave Enemies. About the time Brave Enemies was published, my publisher asked if I'd be interested in writing a biography. And I was. So I wrote the biography of Daniel Boone, called Boone. And that did well. It was a very successful book, and my publisher was interested in the sequel, which I wrote, Lions of the West. Mm-hmm. But almost as soon as Lions of the West was finished, I knew I had to get back to Hank and Julie and their story. And it occurred to me, finally, after all those years, that the narrator of the sequel would not be Julie herself. She had told her story. That would be her daughter, Annie. It would be the story of the next generation. And once I got that idea, I wrote the draft, the first draft, pretty quickly, really in about 4 months. It was as though Annie dictated it to me and I just had to write it down. Then I spent, at least 6 months revising it.
In the time, and as you suggested, you were not sitting idle. You were writing an awful lot of fiction and nonfiction. Mm-hmm. In the 12 or so years in between Gap Creek and now the road from Gap Creek. But had you been imagining sections, sort of sitting down and either writing or at least imagining sections of the sequel?
I did. I knew the story would go through the Great Depression and the typhoid epidemic of the 1920s and up to World War II. That one of the central characters would be Troy, the son who's the favorite son, the favorite brother who's killed. And the book opens with them getting the news of his death, in fact. And dealing with the grief of his death is the very center of the book. Though Annie's story does swing all the way back to the days they were walking up the road from Gap Creek and arriving on Green River. And the things like the typhoid epidemic and then the Great Depression, dealing with the Great Depression.
And we learn right away the difference between Annie, who is quite outspoken, and compare that with her mother's reticence and almost inability to express her emotions.
She has a lot more confidence in her voice than Julie does. And part of the challenge of writing Gap Creek was to write a story in the voice of a woman who has so little confidence in her voice. She says, I don't talk good. I don't know how to tell you this, which is, of course, a kind of artistic trick because she has to tell you about the marriage and their struggles. But that really was the problem I faced writing Gap Creek. How do you get this woman to tell her story, this young woman? And it took me several years to get that voice.
How much do you do? Because in this opening passage where we learn of Troy's death in World War II. There's a way in which we see her silence and her reticence by reflection when her husband puts his hand on her shoulder to comfort her, and she simply can't respond. I mean, there's a way in which her inability or unwillingness to express herself is seen in that way by reflection in the eyes and in the hands of others.
She has always expressed herself by working, all through her life, working for her children, her husband, and before that for her parents and her sisters. But by the time Troy is killed, she is emotionally exhausted. And it's not clear how she feels about her marriage at this point. She is very quiet, and it is by reflection we get her personality, particularly when she's in a low mood, when she has the blues. She won't say much. She just continues with her working. She's loosely based on my grandmother, who was named Julie, and was that sort of person, actually. She just spent her life working for other people, basically.
When you create a character like that, of course, there's a danger that there's a way in which we're characterizing all mountain women as somehow keeping things inside. The good thing about Annie is we see, oh, well, if you thought that was true, wait till you meet her.
Right, and my story, The Truest Pleasure, which is about Jenny, based on the other grandmother, who's a very outspoken woman and a very emotional person. And Jenny figures in The Road from Gap Creek. Actually, she's back because The Road from Gap Creek is a sequel not only to Gap Creek, but to This Rock and The Truest Pleasure, because two families are now united in marriage.
Annie's voice is, tell us about her. When it occurred to you that this book should be written in her voice, were you surprised?
I was surprised because I knew her voice would be somewhat different from Julie's. She's better educated. She's more confident. But she still has a little bit of the mountain dialect, just a little bit. And what I try to do with dialect is to give the flavor of it, not to overdo it, not to use phonetic spelling. I would like to make the voice accessible to any literate reader in the world. And in fact, I was very pleased the way Gap Creek seemed to reach out to people in different parts of the country, in Canada and Australia and New Zealand. I got fan letters from Germany, from Holland.
Well, I think that speaks to the universal quality of your characters. Certainly critics have seen it, and readers as well, that while they are located in a very particular place with their own dialect, there is something universal about their dilemma and the way they work through it.
And there's a kind of paradox I've discovered, that the more local you make something, the more precise to a region, oddly enough, the more universal it is. It really is a kind of contradiction. But if you do something that is very true, that has what I call terroir, as they say, something very, very particular, very specific, very individual, particularly if it's about a struggle. People all over the world understand a struggle, somebody who's struggling to make a living, to feed themselves, to raise children. Those are universal. But the more real you make a story for a particular place, I think the more accessible it is.
It's interesting you say that, because the struggle is universal. We may all have found ourselves in that kind of a bind, and yet there are real particular cultural differences in the way. Just remember the line about Annie talking about the way her mother told her to dress up. You should. Oh, she didn't want to be a preacher's wife because you have to dress up, but not too much. Mm-hmm. And then thinking back to how her mother told her to make up, but not too much lipstick. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a particular regional cultural artifact. Mm-hmm. Not everybody is saddled with that, but they are.
I think that makes it more interesting for the reader. The thing they can understand, but it may be different from their own background. We like to read stories about interesting people, whether they're really very similar to us or not. In fact, often the difference is part of the fascination. American fiction has been just a succession of discoveries of different parts of the country and different cultures. 70, 80 years ago, it was the discovery of the South. The Deep South, writers like Faulkner and others, and then the Jewish community, and right after World War II, the great discovery and the work of Saul Bellow and Bernard Malamud and people like that. More recent times, ethnic groups, not only African Americans, but Asian Americans and American Indian culture and that sort of thing. We learn about ourselves from reading fiction.
Will you read for us?
I will be happy to. One of the paradoxes about Annie is that she's very shy. She is afraid, for instance, to stand up and give speeches, but she discovers that she can act. She's playing a role. She can get up in front of people. And I'll just read a short passage where she's talking about starring in the senior play at Flat Rock High. She says, "I'd never been on a stage in front of so many people before, and I admit I felt a little nervous as the big night approached. I know nearly the whole school and families and people from the community would come. Papa would drive us to school in his new Model A truck, with Mama and me in the front and the boys riding in the back. When I got to school and went backstage to put on my dress, I could hear the crowd on the other side of the curtain, and my hands trembled a little. My costume was a kind of sundress with low shoulders and a short skirt, almost short of shorts. I swallowed and suddenly felt so scared I wanted to tell Mr. Oswald I was sick or just run away into the night. But other kids in the play started coming in and putting on their costumes, and it was too late. I prayed that if I could get through the play without making a complete fool of myself, I'd never act again. Some people said the theater was a sin, and maybe I was being punished for taking part. Before the curtain went up, I was trembling, and it felt like my feet had turned to ice. But as the curtain lifted and the lights hit my face, it was like a weight was lifted off me. I opened my mouth to say the first lines and stepped forward into my part. Nobody in the audience could see me. All they could see was Priscilla. It was like I stepped through some kind of wall and was in contact with people out there in the dark. I said my lines with all the feeling and meaning I could give them."
Robert Morgan reading from his latest, The Road from Gab Creek. Of course, a Henderson County native now teaching up in Ithaca at Cornell. When Annie's voice came to you and this book began telling itself to you, as you said, were there moments when you went back to Gap Creek and, you know, sort of heard things that she would have said, or even wonder if things would have been a little bit different in that original book now that you know her a little bit better?
I didn't, actually. I wanted to move into this new time and this new voice. I didn't go back to Gap Creek. I can obviously remember it.
Right.
Remember Julie's voice, and I think I once realized I had given about 300 readings and talks about Gap Creek over the years. So I do remember that book. But I wanted not to do that. I wanted to move ahead into this new time with these new people, a different generation. So I had this feeling I was just moving into this new time and the new place.
You're teaching, as we said, at Cornell. How much does your writing, and you have populated these books with a universe, the universe that makes up this and the sequel, and as you say, other works of fiction. Not all of your writers, not all of your students kind of have that sort of imagination. I mean, how do you sort of work with young writers? How do you teach creative writing?
Well, the challenge of teaching writing is you have to deal with every single student in a different way, depending on who they are, what their talents are, if they're just beginners, are they have they already achieved something. Every student is different, and teaching writing is harder than teaching anything else because of that. You really give yourself to the students. I tell them in seminars that the first day, this is not about a body of knowledge that I'm going to be presenting to you. This is a place for you to present what you can do. I want to see what you can do. And I often joke with them. I say, in acting classes, you're told to never be caught acting. In writing fiction, never be caught writing. You're telling a story.
Can I get you to read for us again?
Let me read a little bit more of that scene I was reading from. She's up there acting in the senior play, and she says, "From the first, the audience hung on every word and every move I made. Jason forgot his lines once, and Mr. Oswald prompted him from behind the drapery, but it didn't make no difference. The audience laughed at things that was funny and kept quiet most of the time. There wasn't even much coughing. In the last scene, after I died of a broke heart, Jason was supposed to carry me off stage. I told him at every rehearsal to carry me with my head toward the audience, for if I was turned the other way wearing the short skirt, the people could see all the way up to my bloomers. Well, we got through the play, and the audience liked us and even clapped sometimes after a scene they liked special. So when I died, Jason picked me up. But I reckon he was nervous and forgot and held me so my legs was toward the audience and my skirt was pulled up even higher. Even though I was supposed to be dead, I reached out and pushed my skirt down as far as I could. And the audience started laughing, and then they roared. Maybe they thought that was in the play, for they started clapping like they would beat their hands to rags and bones. Mr. Oswald was beaming as we came off the stage. Now, Mr. Oswald was a very shy man. He'd blush even talking to a class. But I reckon he was so thrilled to have the play over and to have such a big crowd and such applause, he wasn't hardly at himself. As soon as Jason put me down, Mr. Oswald ran over and hugged me and kissed me on the cheek. There was tears in his eyes, and he said, "You're wonderful, wonderful." But the clapping continued, and we had to go out on the stage and take a bow.
Robert Morgan reading from the sequel to Gap Creek, The Road from Gap Creek. You talked about the fact that you don't sort of write dialect and kind of change the spellings of words so much. And it's in the cadence for me, where I can hear the mountain in the cadence. You're also a poet. To what extent does your poetry writing affect and influence your fiction?
Well, all my first books were books of poetry, and for about 15 years I worked almost exclusively on poetry, though I had started out to write fiction. But I really consider myself a poet who also writes fiction and nonfiction. The heart of my writing, I think, has been poetry, and I think I've used a lot of what I learned from writing poetry in writing prose, both fiction and nonfiction. And in later years, I think I've used a lot of what I learned from writing fiction in my poetry, as a matter of fact. There's more dramatic and more narrative elements in the poetry.
Robert Morgan, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Robert Morgan, the author of The Road from Gap Creek. And that's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. And if you have a comment about the show or want to hear an archived edition, our website is stateofthings.org. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.